It's not a girl thing, it's a skills thing.
Welcome to a new podcast of Women in Sport, where we bring you curated stories and learn together as we delve into the main debates in the field.
Here with you are your hosts, Sophie Timmerman and Tess Mosterlis. Today we talk to Dr. Gemma Almond. Gemma is a former elite athlete, a swimmer, and some of her sporting highlights include a bronze medal at the European Championships in 2011 and two finals at the London 2012 Paralympic Games. We're really glad she could join us here today, so let's get started. Welcome, Gemma.
I'm ready.
Your sister was also still an athlete, also a swimmer in fact. Is swimming something you got into because of your family, your environment? What did it mean for you growing up? I guess the question is, why swimming?
There was an element of both, really. My sister swam. She was scared of the water, so they put her into swimming lessons really early to help her overcome that. It wasn't the case for me. I always loved the water, but I just jumped in quickly straight after because she was 4 years older than me. So it meant I started lessons quite early because I wanted to copy her. So I started like that, but I think I fell in love with the water at age four because I had four major operations from age four upwards. And after every operation, I'd have hydrotherapy. And I think that just really connected me with water and love for water. It was a pain-free environment and it was really good for me. So it's something my parents then encouraged forward, and I joined a swimming club. And my sister swam all the way through uni, and she was at Loughborough. And then by the time I got to uni, swimming had pretty much become my life. I was swimming at quite a high level by that point. So I think it was a mixture, really. Family, but also the role of hydrotherapy. And it's still now like the one place I can go and my joints don't hurt. So it's a nice environment for me.
At what point did you realize, hey, I'm really good at it, and maybe there's something I can do with that?
It was age 10 because of my condition, I don't have hip joints at all. So I'd always come last at every single sports day. And like, I love PE, but I was obviously never very good at it. And then, you start competing in swimming at age 8. And then that's the earliest you can do it, like small level competitions. And then at county level, the first year is age 9. And then at age 10, so my second counties, I became county champion. And considering I lost every school competition, which was just like 8 kids, but I could swim faster than able-bodied children in my county, I think it was the first time I thought, actually, no, I actually can do this. It was because in some ways, because I had all the operations, I had more upper body strength than anybody of my age. So I was a bit kind of more over able at that point. It then started to go backwards, but still at age 10, I was county champion. And that's almost one of my proudest moments, I think, because I overturned quite a lot of perceptions of what I might be able to do.
And I think in that way, you are an example for a lot of other people. So how did you realize that is something you want other people also to do and engage with, you know, to give them hope that, hey, you know, you can be really good at something, even though others might tell you that you can't?
I think it was probably when I started competing in disability sport. I didn't do that until I was about, I think my first competition within disability sport itself was about age 13 or 14. So it was quite a bit later. But I just saw how much it changed the lives of all of us participating in it. One of the things I am still quite passionate about is access to sport. And there are a number of charities encouraging that. But it's really difficult sometimes for someone who has been told they can't do things or feels like they haven't got confidence in what they look like or how their body functions, to be able to actually get into sport and feel confident in that area, particularly when they could have had experiences like me where they sucked at PE and all those sorts of things. So I think early teens is probably when I started to really think about it and think about, I guess I saw firsthand the value and the benefit of sport if you have an impairment. So probably quite young, really.
One thing I always find very interesting is the topic of funding. Was that easy for you getting access and to funding? And what are sort of the ways others can get started? Because that, I imagine, might be an obstacle for some to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose it's one of the benefits of swimming. So unlike other Paralympic sports where you might need specialised equipment, swimmers... So if you have a very severe disability, you might need lifting into the pool or support in that area. But other than that, you don't wear prosthetics or anything like that. You just use your body. So you just need access to a swimming pool, which obviously does still cost. So I think for that, I was quite lucky because I didn't need any additional funding to be able to swim. And most people wouldn't. But that's also where Activity Alliance comes in. So they work with each kind of area of the country to try and ensure that the facilities are there and that they're, whether that be the gym or anywhere or a sports hall, etc., that they have the equipment to be able to do it. And it's not the children or adults themselves that have to fund that. It should be services that are already there and provided so that they can take part on an equal level, I guess. They don't have to pay any extra to be able to do it. But yeah, that is one of the benefits of swimming. You didn't need any additional equipment. You just needed your body in the water, because it's not like running or trying to throw where you might need something to help in that area, or you don't need a specialised expensive wheelchair, etc. So it does kind of come in handy for that.
In your case, while you were studying and competing, were you supported or did you have to use personal funds?
No, I was supported very, very well. So I was supported through UK Sport on the one hand. So so once you get to a certain level in Paralympic or able-bodied sport, you will start to become eligible for funding. And so that runs through UK Sport. So I was supported by them just because I was competing at an elite level for quite a while. But Swansea University also supported me incredibly well. I wouldn't have been able to kind of study and swim alongside without both types of support. So they awarded me scholarships both for sport and for academic performance. So they funded me at BA level and MA level, and then obviously it was my supervisor at Swansea that then helped me apply for my PhD funding. So whilst I was funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council for my PhD, I do still kind of think if I hadn't gone to Swansea, I might not have ever got that funding either. So I am incredibly indebted to Swansea. They've supported me throughout the whole of my BA and MA. And it's not even just financially, I suppose. I think the other things, if you're studying and swimming at the same time, you need some level of flexibility. And they were always really accommodating when I had a competition or a training camp over the exam seasons. I'd do alternative assessments if required. And it was just little things like that that really made the experience a fruitful one, and one that was really positive all the time. I was never kind of stopped from doing any of my swimming events. I was always allowed to do that and put that first, whilst also still able to get my degree and ensure that I was completing assessments. So from that side, the university were incredibly supportive.
When you read media reports about Paralympic sports or about people with disabilities practicing sports in a higher level, usually the disability is mentioned right away. Is that something that is important to you, or would you rather be recognized as a standalone athlete?
It's a really tricky one. It really depends. I think sometimes, in some ways, it's important. I think people could be more inclined to be offended if... So one thing that you often can get is people... People don't really understand or maybe aren't aware. So it's not a judgment of the people that do it themselves. But a lot of people, we tend to call Paralympians Olympians. And I think that's more of an issue rather than foregrounding the disability, perhaps, because I think Paralympians have a very good, strong sense of identity. They're aware that the movement has taken much longer to gain funding or media appeal and attraction to help in that funding and to help make the events well populated with a good size audience and have it at a professional level. So I think equating Paralympians to Olympians can be an issue. If the disability is foregrounded, for me personally, it doesn't bother me. It would bother me, I think, if it became something to kind of ignite pity. But if it is just simply a descriptor, then I'd be more comfortable with that, because at least then they would then be discussing me in a Paralympic context and not in an Olympic context, which is more important, I think, to me.
What do you think is currently missing in the debate on Paralympic sports or disability sports in general?
There's a few things that sometimes can be an issue. I don't think they're missing in debates with people perhaps involved in the charities, involved in the sports themselves. But a few things that I've guessed missing in the media would be the idea that every disabled person can become a Paralympian, and that if a disabled person wants to take part in sport, they're going to then push towards the Paralympic level. And I think it's something that came out of London 2012. And whilst that movement was absolutely incredible for changing public perceptions of Paralympic sport, it was quite, I guess, in some ways misleading, in the sense that people then started to presume, well, any disabled person could become a Paralympian. All of them would want to. So I think that's sometimes something, from speaking to other friends that have disabilities, that can be sometimes quite challenging, because they just want to go and do sport. They want to just go to the gym. It's not like it's effectively was like suggesting everybody could become Olympian or would want to become Olympian. So I think that's kind of missing in the public debate about Paralympic sport, that actually it's a person with a disability with quite an exceptional high level, or with a keen drive to become an elite athlete, which obviously not everyone possesses. So I think that's there. And I think the other thing that's potentially missing, which I would love to research one day, is the perception of disability and activity. And a lot of, so the Activity Alliance is doing quite a lot of research into many people with disabilities not wanting to take part in sport for fear of losing their benefits and funding, etc., because of that equation with, well, if you can do sport and activity, then do you need any help with your day-to-day living? So I think that's quite an important area that's going to emerge in debates over the next few years.
And because you just mentioned the media, one common criticism with sports is that men usually tend to dominate the headlines. What's your experience in Paralympic or disability sports? Do you think that's a bit more balanced?
It's potentially a little bit more balanced. Just thinking on the top of my head, I think there's equally prominent female and male Paralympians, particularly in the British context. I don't know. I think actually, in some ways, it's potentially a more even level playing field, because the body is configured in a completely different way in Paralympic sport, and I think that's handy. I think often that can get in the way of male and female kind of elite athlete representation. So I don't think it's maybe quite to the extent, from what I'm aware of. It's not something I've ever really noted, and I think that is because in the British context there is a real balance in terms of the people that are exceptionally prominent and get discussed in the media from a male and female perspective. It's an interesting one though, and something I'm going to go look into a little bit more. It's an interesting one.
One thing you mentioned before is, you know, how easy it is to just jump into the water. And I think I read somewhere that you said you picked Swansea specifically because of the Welsh national pool. What was it with Swansea that you just decided to do your undergrad, your grad, your PhD there?
Yeah, so when I came to Swansea, it's all slightly reconfigured now a little bit. But when I came to Swansea back in 2011, it was the Welsh High Performance Centre. So with Wales National Pool as kind of the hub of Welsh swimming. That still is the case. But at the time when I arrived, it also, as well as being the Welsh hub, it was also a high performance centre for Paralympic swimming. And there used to be three in the country, one in each. So Scotland, England and Wales, and that was where Wales's was. So I came for the pool and then also for the training centre there, because there was I think a group of about 12 of us, and obviously it was 2011, so we were all training into London, so it was a really nice I guess team feel, which attracted me. But I think also, which is incredibly important, is the pool was right next to the campus, and the campus of Swansea is very, very small too. So I came, one, because I did want to come to university and study, but I guess what I wanted to study here was really good. So luckily Swansea has a lot of expertise in disability history, which is what I look at. So that did attract me to the university. But it was the location of the pool and the quality of the coach. So he's coached by Billy Pye, who's Ellie Simmons's coach. So he's a really, really very good Paralympic coach for swimming.
While you were training for the European Championships, you were still studying at Swansea. How was it to juggle academic life mm-hmm. with your training?
It was hard, but I was aided in that I wasn't alone in it. So I lived with swimmers who were in the able-bodied high performance centre and training to a similar standard. So that did really help. But I think when I added it up, so it's something like 24 hours, 20 to 26 hours, depending on the week. But that was just literally the time exercising. I also was there an hour before and an hour after pre-pool. So when you add it up, it's a ridiculous amount of hours spent at the pool. So then juggling that with actually trying to study was really tough. We would often have to work on our weekends to make do and not really have any time off. And we were up at 5 pretty much every day. We'd have one morning off in the week and then a Sunday morning off. But other than that, it was kind of up at 5 every day. So it was a little bit challenging, but I think it sets you up quite well for life after university, because we all learn how to time manage very, very effectively and how to really be efficient in the work that we're doing. In some ways, it's not the typical university experience, but we had the best times because we'd go out and do competitions together and we'd have such a good team feel, and it was just kind of a different form of socialising and relaxing to the average student. So it was hard, but it set me up. Certainly training into Europeans was even harder because I was in Masters by that point. So when I started my PhD, I had to make the decision, one or the other, really. Undergrad was much easier to balance.
Did you ever think you would end up in academia when you first started out studying at Swansea?
Oh, I don't know. Part of me, yes, I think. I was always a bit of a nerd, I guess, growing up. I loved books. I loved just learning. So, yeah, I think so in some ways. But it was also something that just kind of evolved as I went through. And I think, again, swimming linked to that, because I did my undergrad, knew I wanted to carry on swimming, and thought, well, I didn't want to just swim. I never just wanted to swim. And it's difficult to work whilst training full time because of the hours. So I just thought, well, I might as well do my master's. And I guess it was kind of in my master's where I really did start to think, I love research, because you get to do a great body of research and you get to lead that a little bit more. So I think, I guess by master's, I was like, no, that's actually something I want to do. And because of how it worked, and I knew I wanted to then think about a PhD, you had to like obviously start applying straight away and at the beginning of the master's. So I kind of just made the decision then. And actually, really, by the end of master's year, when I realised I had my PhD funding and I had that to look forward to in the September, it did kind of take over, and I decided to retire from sport to focus on academia. It wasn't just for the love of academia, but my body was tired by that point. So I think a lot of people don't talk about the retirement from sport and how tricky that is for a person's identity, and kind of just being able to step away. It's probably the hardest thing an athlete ever does. So I was really lucky that I was stepping away and found that really, really, really tough, but stepping into something that I absolutely loved and I could kind of throw my life into in a different way.
Can you tell us a bit about your PhD?
Yeah, it's a slightly random topic. I remember when I told my mum and sister that I had the funding, they laughed at me. My dad in the background didn't, so I liked him at that moment. I won funding to be a collaborative PhD with the Science Museum in London as well as at Swansea. And they had a whole collection of spectacles, so eyewear, that had never been studied, and the history of eyewear has never been studied. So I looked at the 19th century, effectively, the history of vision testing in eyewear. One of the things, I guess, that is kind of my main research now that stemmed out of that is that's the period in which they diagnose the conditions of the eye for the first time and start to measure the eye against normal and abnormal. And that got me really interested in classification of the body, because in Paralympic sport, obviously, everybody is in a classification and measurement, etc. And then I have some academic colleagues at different universities also looking at this for different bodily conditions in the 20th century. So that's kind of where I think my research is going. How do we measure the body? What are the kind of potential issues with that? And what are the outcomes? I basically looked at the diagnosis of vision and then the treatment with spectacles in the 19th century. So very far away from my swimming, but very good fun.
The pandemic has obviously changed a lot and to some degree halted sports. And there are some reports that say 2/3 of all people that die of COVID or with COVID had some form of disability. So I thought that was a quite striking number. What do you think can be done differently or better to raise awareness for the fact that people with disability are affected differently by the pandemic?
So it links a little bit to what my research interests are, in that how do you promote healthiness in a population of people with disabilities, where in some ways, without getting too political, the funding for their living allowances are based on level of activity and therefore in some ways discourage activity in some of the healthy ways of living. And for them to seek help from charities like the Activity Alliance that can adapt sport and help make sport more inclusive so that people can participate in them. But I think it's also just kind of raising awareness. I did see actually this week on the national news, so I think it was on BBC and also on ITV, it didn't look at just all disabilities as a whole, but it was looking at the relationship between people with learning disabilities and their predisposition to seemingly getting COVID and become diagnosed and then also dying from it. And I think it's just, I guess, media awareness to help with that, but then also a general kind of promotion of, I think, that healthy living and allowing people with disabilities to have access to those sorts of facilities. Again, it requires funding, but I think things like that really do help both mental and physical well-being, because obviously mental well-being is something that's really coming out of this pandemic too, and I think that needs to be addressed too, post-pandemic and in pandemic.
So the pandemic has also meant that the Paralympics in Tokyo were postponed from last year to this August. What does it mean for an athlete not to compete or to postpone a competition for 1 year?
It's huge. It's so, so huge. And I think, obviously, most athletes have perspective, so they understand why games can't go ahead and understand that, you know, they're missing out on the games perhaps can't be equated with people losing their loved ones. But you train 4 years for games. The mental toll on not being able to compete when you have... So you do... Most athletes will have done a four-year plan and they'll be getting better each year, but the idea would be to be at peak performance at that date. And then you'd have had a big break after that and then gone back in. So they would have not only been at their peak level. So March was when it started to become a bit iffy and people started to lose their trials. So you'd have a trials event where you qualified before going to the games. So people losing their trials was obviously a massive kind of toll on their mental well-being in many ways, because they've been training for this for 4 years and then suddenly the qualifying events disappeared. How do we cope with that? And then obviously then the games were told they weren't going ahead. And so they have no drive, no goal, no purpose. And then the flip side of that was then they then need to just carry on training almost once they could get back in the pool after the when facilities reopened, because they've got to train for next year, which is now obviously this year, and there's no guarantee now. And I've got a number of friends still training at the elite level, should have been in Tokyo in various different sports, and it's been really, really, really hard for them because it's their life. It's everything they've put their work into. And I think it's the uncertainty. If there was a definite no, it's not taking place, or yes, it is. But at the moment, they're training at a really high level and they don't know what they're training for. And they've got no alternatives, really, because they're full-time athletes. They're funded to train full-time. So not missing a games is a massive thing. It's had a massive toll on people's mental well-being.
One question we meant to ask you at the very beginning, but I think it aligns really well with what you were just saying, is that there's something so special about the Paralympics, and then having them at home in 2012 for you must have been, I can only imagine, really extraordinary. But apart from that, do you have a great sporting moment that you think topped everything else?
There's probably two. My favorite ever sporting moment would have been qualifying for London 12 rather than the games itself in some ways. I know it sounds quite bizarre, but it was kind of the realization that I was actually going, which in some ways was, it just was the best feeling ever. And at that qualifying event, I was in a lane next to Ellie Simmons, who I trained with in Swansea and is one of my best friends. And we trained so hard on this event, and she broke the world record in her category and I broke the British record in my category, and we both qualified. And that for me was kind of a really like pinnacle of my career, and I knew I was going. And then I think linked to that, kind of the best sporting moment, I think, would probably be Ellie Simmons' 400 freestyle at London 2012.
The crowd are going bonkers, absolutely bonkers for Eleanor Simmons. A huge world record, absolutely massive.
Obviously, I didn't compete in that, but I got to watch it. And I think it would still be on YouTube and things, but the tension of that event and the noise. Her and her rival kind of neck and neck for 5 minutes, basically.
Eleanor Simmons is into the lead.
It was absolutely phenomenal. And when she won, the noise was absolutely amazing. And I think just linked to that, I think it was just the noise of all the crowds at London 2012, whatever venue you went into. It was just so jam-packed and so supportive. And just such an incredible environment and feeling that I think, yeah, that would probably be the best sporting moment in many ways, just the level of support that we had and the atmosphere.
Do you ever miss competing and that feeling of adrenaline at the start?
Yeah, I do. I do, absolutely. And I think I also miss being at like peak level of fitness. I loved training. I was one of those weirdos that generally really quite liked pushing my body and slogging away. And then by the time you got to competition, you really were like, you were rested and you were just ready to go. And I miss that feeling. I miss the feeling of being, in some ways I don't miss the nerves, but I do miss standing in the call room just about when you're about to go on and you just think, right, got to get into the zone. Because you can't really replicate that in normal worlds. In some ways, it's why I do quite like doing academic conferences and lectures and talking and things, because it does almost mimic that adrenaline rush before you talk, but it's not the same.
Do you see any parallels between the world of sport and academia?
Yeah, I do. I think there's in some ways there needs to be kind of a bit of research into this. Yes, and I think if you're an athlete, you're well set up for academia. So to do a PhD, for example, it's 3 whole years. And if you've been training on 4-year cycles, the 3-year planning thing just doesn't even phase you. You know how to do that. And that would be quite overwhelming for people. But I think it's the way you work translates really well from sport into academia. It requires dedication, passion, time, the ability to overcome setbacks and all of those sorts of things that make you very resilient, and you need to be resilient in academia. It's not an easy career pathway, and research can be really challenging. So I think, yes, I think athletes do make very good academics in some respects because of how they work. And that's why support becomes really important at university level, to recognise that student athletes actually have a lot of potential, but they might need to be flexible in that because they have dual commitments.
Imagine yourself as a first-year student at university. If you could talk to that younger version, what advice would you give her?
I guess enjoy it more and make the most of it. It went so fast, and I think I wish I could have told myself where I'd go on to go so that I could have more confidence, I think. It was a really special time that I'll never get back. Being an athlete and being on a team was really, really, really special. So I think I'd just probably say savor it a bit more and stop stressing so much. You are going to be okay. So just kind of take all the positives from it and kind of relax.
We're so happy you could join us today in Woman in Sport. A special thank you to Dr. Dema Almond for being our first guest. I, Tess Mostelis, and my co-host Sophie Timmerman hope to continue to bring you exciting new topics.
If you want to join us on this journey, make sure to follow us. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and Amazon Music.
And if you like the show and want to support us, you can become our Patreon on patreon.com/womansportpodcast. See you next time.